It's a C3 project. Continuous core content. Clinical approaches to emergency medicine's most common and dangerous conditions.
Go.
Let's just set the stage by saying what we're talking about here is walking and talking patients.
He's Stuart Swadron. My name's Mel Herbert, and we're going to be talking about an approach to headache.
So we're not talking about the patient who says they have a headache and then they're altered and their blood pressure is 250. We're talking about patients that come in purportedly with that as their chief event going on as a headache.
Before Stuart gets too deep into this, I want to ask you to listen right at the very end of this recording because I want to tell you how this program is going to evolve in the next few months. Let's get back to Stuart. Let's talk about headache.
Let's play a little game with this. And as we're going through, we'll talk about the different entities. Let's make sure that we identify the specific things that you need to have on your chart when that patient walks out of there. Because 99% of these patients are going to walk out of there, right? You're going to make them feel better from their headache, but you want to make sure that your chart reflects the fact that you look for all the critical things that you didn't want to miss.
Got it.
Fair enough?
The red flags, they're called. The concerning things that make you think about something more than just a bad headache.
So just before we talk about the types of headache, I think the best place to start is with treatment. Not with diagnosis, with treatment.
Say what?
And that's very important because there is no utility in having the person that's come to you with a headache sit there and suffer with their headache while you're asking them a million questions about their headache to find a diagnosis. Now, in terms of treatment, we basically have about four or five categories of drugs that we can pick from. And really, there's no right or wrong answer here. You have to really tailor the treatment to the individual patient. For example, what did the patient take before they got to you? Is this a patient who's on chronic medications? Are there going to be interactions with their other medications? So I don't want to really be dogmatic about this, but I do want to outline the basic choices in front of you. Now, first off, let's not discount non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and acetaminophen. Both are used to treat headache. Both are effective, and that might be the treatment of choice. That might be what you're going to institute. You're going to give the patient something PO and then reassess them after some time interval, maybe turn the lights down in the room, come back, and then see if they're better. One thing that we've learned over the years is that the faster the drug gets into the brain, the more effective it tends to be against headaches, especially chronic recurrent headaches like migraines. That's why if you use effervescent aspirin like Alka-Seltzer, and that sometimes comes in much larger doses than the traditional 325 milligrams that you see in ASA, because of the way that it fizzes up with the carbon dioxide, it gets absorbed quicker and actually has been shown to be more effective. And that, of course, leads us to the concept of using intravenous medicine to treat headaches. I think for everyone's edification, you should know that the dopamine antagonists, which are generally administered intravenously, so we're talking about prochlorperazine, which is Compazine, metoclopramide, which is Reglan, chlorpromazine, which is Thorazine, these are the US brand names, are very effective at getting rid of just about every type of headache. And we're talking about efficacy rates in the 80-90% range, much higher than you're going to see with acetaminophen and ibuprofen. Now, you can actually use these medications intramuscularly, and they're still quite effective, but you're going to lose 10 or 20% of the cure rates. When given IM, these drugs might work 60 or 80% of the time. And you know what? When you start to give them orally, they're really not that effective, almost kind of like placebo rates, 40%. And so they're more appropriate in the emergency department or urgent care environment.
Nothing, Stuart. Nothing in this world is free. Talk to me about side effects. What's the side effect profile of these drugs, particularly given IV?
The most important side effect that you need to be aware of, and we're not going to go through all of them, is QT prolongation. And so if the patient has a history of that, or if they're on a bunch of medicines that also prolong the QT interval, like erythromycin, certain heart medications, then you're going to probably want to choose something different, especially in the urgent care environment where you might not be as prepared to deal with these side effects.
All right, I got it. I'm tracking with you. What about the abortive medications like the sumatriptans and their friends and cousins?
These are medicines that can be very effective, especially in the early stages or in the aura phase of a headache. These are totally appropriate to administer in the emergency or the urgent care settings, especially when patients have established diagnoses and have taken the medicines before. Now, there are other medications out there that are used to treat headache. This can't be an exhaustive discussion, but one thing I do want to hit upon before we move on is opioids. It is acceptable to use opioids to treat headache pain, especially in patients that have tried other agents, you've tried other agents, and you're not getting anywhere, but we really need to be careful. The fact of the matter is that whether using oral or intravenous agents, opioids actually aren't as effective as a dopamine antagonist. And I don't have to tell anyone out there that this is a real problem in America.
So you're going to treat them up front with some analgesia to make them feel better while you gather more information. And the most important thing there is that response to simple analgesia is not a diagnostic test. You can have a bad thing that responds to Tylenol. So that's the key, right?
That's exactly right, Mel. That's a key point. You can't make a diagnosis just judging on how they respond to your therapy.
All right, Stuart, then let's talk about diagnosis. How are we going to make these diagnoses?
None of us want to miss something bad. So there are two basic types of headaches in general. There's primary and secondary headaches, right? We have to distinguish the two. Really straightforward. The primary headaches are the ones that patients come in with over and over again, the migraines, the clusters, the tension headaches, and any headache that is not one of those that's of new onset, they haven't had it before, is by definition concerning for something bad, a secondary headache. Your meningitis, your tumors, your subarachnoid hemorrhage. And the whole workup of headache revolves around that issue of separating the primary from the secondary headaches.
So a history of recurrence and a history of treatments in the past is very important up front. It guides your therapy and it guides your workup.
That's precisely right. Now let's just talk about some of the main classes of benign, recurrent, primary headaches. Tension headaches are definitely the most common headaches, and those are going to be the most common that we see in lots of different environments. Basically, these are more commonly in men. They're more commonly on both sides. But the thing about tension headaches, Mel, is that they usually have some sort of pretty straightforward cause in the patient's life. It's something about their sleep schedule. It's something about stress in their life. It's something else that you can probably put your finger on. They might be depressed. So a lot of patients that are coming in repeatedly with tension headaches to the clinic setting probably have an underlying issue that needs to be dealt
with. Right.
Let's talk about migraines for a moment.
Yeah, a lot of patients have recurrent headache and pain, and we get really caught up in, is this a migraine exactly, or is this just a bad recurrent headache? And you know what? Probably doesn't matter.
I don't think it makes a difference, because any patient that is chronic, recurrent, and bad enough to land them in the doctor's office or in a clinic, it could be called a migraine. You know, the definition of migraine is not really that scientific. I think it's reasonable to kind of lump those into that category together. Listen, they're just all primary headaches in the end of the day. For sure, there are features of the classic migraine that stand out from other types of chronic recurrent headaches, from tension, for example, like they have an aura. And an aura is basically just a warning sensation or a perception that the headache is about to come on. They also have a lot of visual sensations that are associated with them. Colored lights, little holes in the visions, and those are called scintillations and scotomata. They also might really hate the sound and really hate the light, and so they want to be in a quiet, dark room. All those things, though, Mel, aren't really critical in differentiating them from tension headache. They're not. And in the setting that we're in, okay, when we're seeing these patients at a point where they can't take the pain anymore, all the same approaches and the same classes of medications are the ones that are going to work for them.
Any severe recurrent headache can be classified as migraine, and therefore you can use the usual band of therapies to try it on that patient. Salivish trying to work out, is it tension or is it migraine, is not important. Why then do we care about classic versus common? Is it just because it's fun? We like auras and scintillations and scotomas, or does that in any way change our therapy?
Probably doesn't make a difference. They're in awful pain. They can't take it anymore. They've tried something at home, that type of thing, right? But if you do have an aura with your headache, for example, there's this funny sensation that you get and it usually lasts for 5 minutes or 10 minutes before you have a headache. That's a wonderful opportunity for patients that are on prophylactic and abortive therapies to take their medicines. And so most notably, the patients that are on a triptan could take, for example, a subcutaneous injection of their sumatriptan in that period of aura and actually throw off the headache altogether. And so it's kind of an advantage in some ways to have that aura. The thing is that really screws people up about migraines, Mel, more than anything else, the one big point, the one big medical legal point, is that migraines are known to cause neurological deficits. They can cause some weakness. They can cause an autonomic feature. They can cause all kinds of crazy things, even a blown pupil or things that look like stroke. Well, you know what the bottom line is?
If it looks like a stroke, treat it like a stroke.
Exactly. Exactly. And more people that know a lot about migraine get into more trouble just by making that mistake of slipping into the, oh, well, you know, they had a classic aura. They had a classic type of headache that they usually get. And so I can accept the fact that they're not moving the left part of their body. I can accept the fact that they have some actual hard visual field deficit. No, you can't. You can't. That is something for a neurologist at a very high level to make that determination. And so unless they have a completely established pattern of a migraine that has a certain neurologic deficit and it's getting better or it's better already, you got to be really loath not to hang on to that patient, get them into the ER, and get them evaluated.
There's forms of migraine where they have really bizarre and hard neurological findings, like hemiplegic migraine. When they get migraine, they can't move their left side. But you're saying these have to be absolutely established. The patient has to say, every time I get migraine, I can't move my left arm. And in 5 minutes, it goes away this time. Otherwise, don't be too smart. Just if there's hard neurological findings, treat it as if it's something more serious.
Yeah. And a lot of people have a question, what is a hard neurologic finding? Just in case you're not clear on that, a hard neurologic finding is any finding that could be explained by a lesion in a certain part of the brain, right? So if someone is just confused before their migraine, or they have a funny feeling of being light or on a cloud, I mean, you hear all kinds of funny sensations people have, that's fine. If people during their migraine have funny sensations, they have trouble focusing, that's okay. But once they say they can't move a part of their body, they have a cranial nerve deficit that's positive, they have ataxia, something that's referable to the cerebellum, those things are just, they're not okay.
So headache plus hard neurological findings. You got some ataxia, you got some weakness, you got something, you know, that I can find on examination. That's bad. That's a workup. That's not migraine. Let's do cluster. And yes, if it's recurrent and it's the same thing that they always get with their migraine, that's one thing. But otherwise, this is a workup. Headache plus hard neurological findings.
Okay, next up is cluster. You know, when it comes to cluster headache, we all have learned about it. We've all learned about it in medical school because it's so dramatic and it's so easy to talk about. It's a juicy subject, if you will. These are men, and they come in many times over the course of days, perhaps weeks. And this is cyclic. It could happen to them several times a year. It could happen year after year with these intense, intense headaches that are centered behind one eye usually, and they're so bad that they can't keep still. They're like kidney stone patients. They just are walking all over the place in pain, and they might actually have, and here's the kicker, actual neuro findings like a meiosis or a ptosis, a droopy lid, or lacrimation or facial sweating just out of that one side of their head. And that's something that you'd get with clusters, and it's something that you can accept if it goes away right away after you treat them. But again, just like I'm saying with the patients with migraine, if there's anything that's a hard finding, if this patient's come into you and, for example, you've treated their pain and there's still a cranial nerve deficit, it's a stroke until proven otherwise. The same advice applies.
So we said our first red flag was new onset headache. The second one was hard neurological findings. And so that's the same with migraine, with cluster, with any of these. And cluster is mostly men, and the key features sort of lacrimation, facial swelling, meiosis, ptosis, they're walking around. And the special therapy for that is oxygen, is that right? Or lidocaine up the nose or something?
Yeah, now clusters will respond just like all headaches will respond to these same measures that we talk about, the dopamine antagonists. They'll respond to opioids. But there's a few special treatments that seem to work just for cluster that are, let's face it, they're sexy. They're the kind of things that you use and the nurse says, wow, that's amazing. And so oxygen and as high a concentration as you can muster is what treats these headaches, probably better than anything else. If you put a non-rebreather on them, and that can get your FiO2 up to what, 60, 70, 80% maybe, that's the most effective. So the more oxygen you can put on them, the faster, the better chance you have of getting rid of this headache. Other things that have been described to work if you don't have that immediately available, lidocaine. If you put lidocaine up the nose on the side that's affected, that also has been reported to be very effective.
Yes, a little lidocaine up the schnauzer. Okay, got it. What about medication overuse syndromes?
Well, I think that one of the things that we see over and over and over again, sometimes we know it and sometimes we don't when we see the patients and we interview them, is patients have headaches because they're on headache medication. This actually, Mel, is the third most common cause of headache. For all the attention that cluster headaches get, and they make great exam questions, I know, and they're very dramatic and very fulfilling to see. For all the attention they get, it's the medication overuse headache. It's the patient that maybe started with a tension headache because of a stressful situation or a work problem. They might have migraine headaches, but they're taking so much medicine every day for it that the medicine, that becomes a problem. And anytime they stop taking the medicine, they go into withdrawal. And I think most of us know that happens all the time with the opioids, right? That's a national epidemic in the US. We're all familiar with it. The patient just can't wean off of their opioids. But it's not just the opioids. It's pretty much any medication that we use chronically, including things like caffeine, barbiturates, all these over-the-counter preparations, they can all do this. So you got to take a good medication history here.
So caffeine has got to be the biggest one here. Everybody in the Western world drinks enormous amounts of caffeine. Somebody starts to try and back it off for health reasons and they get headaches. So let's do a roadmap of where we've gone. We've gone from, first of all, just treat their pain. Then we've talked about the first two red flags, and one is new onset headache and then headache with neurological findings. And he's just finished talking about one of the most common causes of headache, which is medication withdrawal or drug withdrawal. So for those people, you just have to ask them, have you stopped doing caffeine or something else? And now let's get into the next series of red flags.
The cardinal headache of all time that is bad, and that is the subarachnoid hemorrhage, okay? And I'm going to tell you, Mel, that you're going to add two red flags to your list. The only two you really need to know for subarachnoid, okay? And that is, was it sudden at onset, and was it maximal when it started? The so-called thunderclap presentation.
So they know exactly when it started. It hurt like hell, and it was maximal within, we used to say seconds, but probably minutes of onset.
Yeah, we know from the recent data that came from Canada that some of these patients, the headache doesn't become maximal actually for a minute or two until it's actually maximal. But for the vast majority of patients, it's a literal thunderclap where it's maximal within seconds of onset. And when you couple that with our first red flag, which is that they've never had this type of headache before, you have to work that patient up for a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Full stop.
So we're talking about our third and fourth red flag, which is sudden onset and maximal at onset.
Mel, any patient that has a fever along with their headache has to make you take notice. Now, sure, a lot of patients are going to have a fever and a headache together. A lot of patients have the flu. They have viral URIs. I'm not saying for a second that it's easy to pick the meningitis patients out of the crowd, but you've got to think about it. And I think that the biggest population that puts us at risk for missing it is patients with immunocompromise. So if I could say one thing about it, yes, it's hard to pick meningitis out of the crowd. Yes, it is. But if they've got HIV, if they're on chronic steroids, if they're alcoholics, homeless patients, they're partially treated with antibiotics. Those patients that are in that category, it's that much easier to miss meningitis. And that's the one thing I would say.
So let's go back and let's do the red flag so far. So we've got new onset headache. We've got headache associated with neurological findings. We've got sudden onset of headache or headache that is maximal at onset. And now we've got headache with fever or headache in an immune compromised patient, both of those suggesting something like meningitis. Got it.
Now, also, Mel, this is really interesting. And don't forget that over the past 25, 30 years, meningitis has changed from being a pediatric disease to being an adult disease, right? This used to be basically something that we worried about when we were studying peds. That's not the case anymore with all the vaccinations out there. So in the adult population, people need to take special care with prisoners, recruits, people in college dorms that are living in close quarters. Meningitis spreads in those closed, confined conditions.
So, Stuart, we're worried about meningitis. What's our initial therapy for these people, be it in the ER, be it in the urgent care, be it wherever we are? What's our initial go-to drugs and therapy as we try and work out, yes, no, this is in fact meningitis?
Time really matters for this diagnosis. And so I think that if you're going to do anything, what you do is you get an IV in these patients, get normal saline up if you've got it, and you give them an initial anchor antibiotic. That would be probably ceftriaxone, a couple of grams of ceftriaxone. That's probably a reasonable approach.
All right, Stuart, so you're going to have to fill me in here. I know that some of these patients actually really do well with steroids, and that should be given early. And some of these patients, when you give them antimicrobials, you can lyse all those bacteria that are causing the meningitis, and they can get really sick. Is this something I need to worry about? Do I give them steroids?
You know, Mel, that's true. There is evidence out there that suggests that giving steroids like Decadron at or before the administration time of the antibiotics does improve outcomes for these patients. And so it's not unreasonable to give them 10 milligrams of Decadron if you really think you have an acute meningitis case and you want to give that before the ceftriaxone. That's reasonable. But keep in mind that if your suspicion isn't that high, or if the patient's also immunocompromised with HIV, for example, there might be a bit of a debate about that. And so it's probably best in those cases just to go ahead and give the ceftriaxone and not worry about the steroids. You know, you mentioned sometimes patients crash after you give them antibiotics with serious infections. That's definitely true. And I've seen it happen with my own eyes. And that's what the IV is about. If you're going to give someone a whack of antibiotics and you think they've got bacteria all through their body, it's nice to have an IV so that you can give them a big bolus of fluid if their pressure does go down when you give them that initial shock of antimicrobial coverage. And the treatment really is intravenous if at all possible. Okay, Mel, here's one for you. I'm an old white lady. Maybe your mom.
Could be. You look a bit like her.
And I have a new onset headache, mm-hmm. and it hurts me over my temporal arteries on both sides of my head. Mm-hmm. And every time I eat, it aches me in my jaw. I have claudication in my jaw. What do I have?
You have a son that's been very bad to you. No. You have a thing which we used to call temporal arteritis, but now is called giant cell arteritis and is a four-alarm fire. This is very concerning. Please tell us about this new term, giant cell arteritis. Old lady, jaw claudication, big, painful temples, something about steroids as you go blind.
You know, the bottom line with this one is that if they actually come in with those symptoms like we just express them, you know, a 70-year-old woman comes in and she says she's got a new onset headache and hurts over her temples, all that stuff, you got to start her on steroids right away empirically. That's the bottom line. And that's the critical action here, is starting them on a decent dose of steroids. You can give them oral, you can give them prednisone, 60 milligrams, 80 milligrams is appropriate. And then they can get set up to get a biopsy done down the road and you can refer them.
Stuart notes that they don't have to see a specialist immediately. As long as you start them on the steroids and get them close follow-up for biopsies and other diagnostic stuff, that would be okay.
As long as you started them on the steroids, and you'd probably want to talk to them on the phone about that as you're making arrangements.
So this is part of those, you know, one of those arterities where that arterial inflammation can result in really bad things if you don't stop it. So the steroids are given to reduce that inflammatory component because they can go blind. Lots of bad things can happen. And if you give the steroids now, you might reduce that progression, but it doesn't change the biopsy results. That's what people always want to know. Well, I better not treat it because then we won't get the diagnosis. No, you can biopsy them days later and still get the diagnosis. So just hit them with the steroids if you're worried about it. So it's classically old lady headache, temporal pain, and then these other things like jaw claudication. So they're chewing their apple and they're just like got angina of the jaw.
Of course, what we're really trying to prevent with these patients by getting them on the steroids is any visual loss. And if you wait long enough, then they'll all actually go end up going blind from this condition. So it is pretty important. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that every new onset headache and an older patient gets put on steroids. It's only those that have really suggestive symptoms like a temporal nodularity or tenderness or the jaw claudication. For any patient who doesn't fit into that very specific group, Mel, it's a good idea to send an ESR. Send a test that is going to screen out the vast majority of these patients. So a new onset headache in a patient who's 70 years old doesn't have any of these real classic features. If the ESR is negative, I'm not going to work them up anymore for this. But if it is high, and you don't have another explanation, they might still need to go on to this group where they see opto and they might get the biopsy of their temporal artery anyway. Now, I know a lot of people are probably thinking, I can't get an ESR back that quickly. And if that's the case, I would still send it and also send a CRP because the CRP will come back quickly and is usually up as well, although the ESR is more of what has been studied.
So the ESR in these patients is usually very high, usually over 100, but it can be just high, 40. 50. So let's go over some of our red flags again. New onset, headache with neurological findings, sudden onset or maximal onset or soon thereafter of onset. And then we're talking about headache in the elderly person with this constellation of symptoms that suggest temporal arteritis. So temporal artery pain, jaw claudication, proximal muscle weakness, that kind of stuff.
Cervical dissection, Mel, is a big issue. This is something that we weren't previously recognizing. And in the past 10, maybe 15 years, we're picking up a lot more of them. And it's become recognized as a cause of stroke. When you see a young person that had a stroke, you know, they're in their 30s and they didn't appear to have the traditional risk factors and they had a stroke, it's a good chance that it was because of a dissection. So we really ought to know what exactly this is all about. And what it's about is it's usually a headache that presents with a sudden onset, just like a subarachnoid.
So they have a sudden onset of headache. And this is actually a dissection of either their carotid artery or their vertebral artery, right? So the artery itself is dissecting, it's sudden onset of pain. They'll often complain if you ask them specifically of a lot of facial pain, as much as the headache. And this is associated with manipulation.
That's the ironic thing, Mel, is that the misperception out there is in order to dissect your main arteries to the head, that you would have to do some major trauma, a big car accident, high force deceleration. In fact, the majority of these are from low mechanism traumas. They were doing yoga. They were dancing. They actually just had a sudden jerking movement in bed when they rolled over. Even benign sounding things like that are the things that seem to cause a dissection. Now, there's probably some predisposition in terms of their connective tissue. We know that people with Marfans, for example, are at much higher risk to get this. But the bottom line is lancinating sudden onset pain, radiating up the neck, either in the back or the front of the neck, that if we don't pick it up, and the way we pick this up is with imaging, by doing an angiogram of some sort, CT angiogram, MR angiogram. If it's not picked up, they can go on to have a stroke. If they do have a dissection that's limited to their carotid or vertebral arteries, it's not something really bigger coming from, for example, the arch of the aorta. That's a bit of a different story. But if it's one of these dissections of just the neck vessels, then they're going to be heparinized most commonly. They're going to be put on anticoagulation, and neurology is going to be looking after them in the hospital.
All right, you got a couple more bad causes of headache, but you've got down here basically that pregnancy in the third trimester and after delivery is a really high risk time to get a headache because there's some bad diseases that can occur then. What are they?
So basically, Mel, if you're pregnant, third trimester, and this goes all the way until about 6 weeks after you deliver, there are two major bad types of headache that have to be on our radar. The first one is dural venous thrombosis. And that's basically the blood clots that you get in the big veins in the brain. And that's because you're in a very hypercoagulable state at the end of pregnancy and just beyond. Now, they can also get it if they have clotting problems and they have a lot of PEs in their past, etc. But I wanted to focus on pregnancy because the other type of really bad headache that is associated with pregnancy is preeclampsia. And one of the biggest misconceptions about preeclampsia is that once a baby's delivered, that you're out of the woods. You're not. And if a woman comes to your ER and it's 3 weeks, 4 weeks, even 5 or 6 weeks after they've had their delivery and they have a new onset headache, both of these diagnoses, dural venous thrombosis and preeclampsia, have to be on your differential.
So dural venous thrombosis is a DVT of the head, basically. You've got these big venous plexuses and you get a clot in them. What do they look like? How are they different from just like I've got a screaming child at home and I've just delivered and I've got a headache versus I've got a clot in my brain and a headache? What do they look like?
Well, then all the fact of the matter is that any new headache, and often these are just described to, oh, you're lifting the baby and that's causing a headache. Any new headache that they haven't had before is a cause for concern. It is true that these headaches tend to be severe. They often come on as a thunderclap, just like subarachnoids do, but they don't have to. And they do get worse with time. Now, if you miss the boat on these, they're going to end up having neurologic symptoms. You might actually be drowsy from it. You might start to get paralyzed. But it's not going to be in the same pattern of symptoms that we see in a stroke, where they have like a hemiparesis, because these are venous distribution. And so the most common thing will be that they're going to start getting drowsier. And that's really scary. You don't want to let things get to that point. So the bottom line is you got to think about it. And if there's any doubt about this, they have to have an MR venogram. And that's something that can only be done in the
So I really hate what I'm about to say, but I have to say it. This is one of those conditions where you have to have that level of suspicion. You have to have heard about this before. You have to understand that pregnancy and post-pregnancy is a high-risk condition for a lot of venothromboembolic disorders, and you can clot off your brain. But this can also occur in men and the non-pregnant, and it tends to be associated with things like dehydration and viral infections. And on an upcoming MRAP, we are going to go into this in quite some detail with an incredible case, but more on that later.
Not only are people really thrown off by the fact that the important preeclampsia presentations with headache happen after delivery, there's a lot of misconceptions around the fact that people think their blood pressure has to be really high, that they have to look really sick. They don't. Again, it's a new headache. They've not had it before, and they just delivered a few weeks ago. You have to think about both of these diagnoses.
So our two next red flags are high risk of clotting patient with a history of PEs and DVTs, and somebody is peri or postpartum.
Okay, next up. Brain tumor.
It's not a tumor.
And what's a brain tumor history?
I've got a headache every morning and it's getting worse and it doesn't go away and I keep taking analgesia and now I'm wobbling and falling over all the time.
Okay, well, even before...
it's progressive over...
Even before you get to the wobbly, it's the progressive nature of it, exactly. And so sure, I'm concerned if the patient says that it's not going away, it's worse in the morning and it's getting worse day by day. Sure, I'm concerned. But if the patient doesn't look sick and they have a normal neuro exam, they're not drowsy, you can actually get their imaging as an outpatient. That's not unreasonable. Now, if they do look sick or they do have anything that concerns you, absolutely. You're going to elevate the head of the bed 30 degrees because if they have a brain tumor that's got swelling, they could have mass effect and that could lead to herniation. So one simple thing you can do is transport them to the ER and elevate the head of their bed 30 degrees. But again, unless they have neuro findings, it's not obligatory to send them to the ER just to get imaging.
All right, so our 10th red flag then is progressive daily headaches, a headache that is there every day, even potentially getting worse day after day. So you need some time to make this diagnosis, but that's a red flag and it's for tumors. But I don't have to necessarily diagnose a tumor today if they're awake and alert and normal.
Carbon monoxide poisoning is another thing that, again, if you don't think about it and it's not on your list, you're going to miss it. And so here, the key points are they present with the flu, with their headache usually, their flu-like illness. And so that's pretty nonspecific. The key is, does anyone else that's living in their environment also have the same symptoms? Does the family dog have the same symptoms? Because dogs also suffer from carbon monoxide poisoning. And so you might not have a lot to go on. And if you don't think of it, you're not going to make the diagnosis.
So how is this diagnosis made? Well, it's made on suspicion, under the circumstances. Lots of people sick, maybe. But then it's about co-oximetry. It's about a specific sort of device that picks up carbon monoxide levels. Your average everyday test doesn't do that.
That requires co-oximetry, and it's something that's usually going to only be available in the hospital. Remember that if you do a pulse ox on these people, it will misleadingly show 100%. If you send a oxygen PO2 on a blood gas alone, that will also mislead you into thinking that there's no problem. You have to do the actual carbon monoxide co-oximetry. So Mel, say I actually had that scenario where a patient came in and they've got a headache and other family members also have the headache and the dog has a headache and you're like...
And they have the hibachi is in the middle of the house because it's really cold outside, right, and they've been cooking inside.
Exactly. So what do you do? What do you do with them?
Those people, the simple therapy is to give them oxygen, oxygen, oxygen. So put them on 100% oxygen.
Well, the mainstay of the treatment is oxygen, and the more you can give of it, the better. The one big issue becomes when we consider hyperbaric oxygen as a way of giving even higher concentrations of oxygen. Because although there's still a lot of controversy about it, that is considered to be the gold standard therapy for people that have carbon monoxide poisoning at high levels or that are having symptoms because of it. So the decision-making in the ER while the patient's on the oxygen that you already started is going to center around yes or no for hyperbaric oxygen treatment.
So you have to measure it directly. I need to know the hemoglobin CO level directly. I can't infer it.
Exactly. Now, just to round out our bad diagnoses and red flags, Mel, just a few more points. First of all, glaucoma. Glaucoma often presents as a sudden onset headache, but I just don't think that many people are going to miss that diagnosis. When you're confronted with that patient with that sudden onset headache, they're going to usually be holding the eye, and the eye itself will be steamy. The pupil's not going to react. It's going to be red as all get out. When these actually get missed, ironically, is in the emergency department, where they're initially seen among several patients that need imaging. They get ordered from triage, and then it's 2 hours before a doc actually sees the patient and realizes, oh my goodness, we just sent the patient to CT because they were holding their head, and it turns out it's glaucoma. We're behind the eight ball. So that's one thing, is look at the eye. And cerebellar infarction is another thing that presents as headache. And the main take-home point there is that dizziness along with your headache, acute dizziness along with your headache, is another red flag, because that patient might have a cerebellar stroke.
All right. So it's a good reminder, any patient with headache, look in their eyes, look in their ears. Not all headache is being generated from the skull out, but sometimes from outside the skull in. So look at the ears, look at the eyes. And then cerebellar infarction, classic. They get a headache, but they also have, usually neurological findings, dizziness, ataxia. Do a good neuro exam. That's a good reminder.
The last red flag I would mention is that there are some patients that might have suffered trauma, like children or elders, people in custody. The history might not be straightforward for those patients because they're in a vulnerable situation. So I would just add that one extra thought to whether or not that patient is at risk, and maybe we should err on the side of transporting them to the ER to get them imaged because of some social issue. That's also important to save lives.
So that was your 12th red flag, occult trauma. And the only way you're going to know about it is by asking and by looking. So I'm going to go through this list of the red flags. And here again is the concept of the red flag. Most patients that you see in variety of practice settings with headache, it's benign. Overwhelmingly, it's benign. But we're going to pick out specific features in the history and the physical exam that suggest that, hang on, maybe this is something more than just a benign headache. You have suggested that there are 12 of these red flags, and you should specifically ask and look for each of these. And so first of all, new onset headache is a concern. Any new onset headache, think about, could this be something bad? Neurological findings. Any hard neurological finding suggests a stroke or something else bad. Sudden onset of headache or headache that is maximal at onset suggests subarachnoid hemorrhage, or it suggests something like a vertebral or carotid dissection. Headache with fever or headache with immune compromise suggest bad things like meningitis. Headaches associated with relatively minor trauma again suggest something like a dissection. Headaches in patients who are at high risk for clots, so known clotting disorder, or that peri or postpartum period. Progressive headache, headache that's worse every day, getting worse, slowly worse and worse, suggests things like tumors. if there are multiple patients presenting with headache, we're going to throw that in now as a red flag. So mum's sick, dad's sick, the kid's sick, and the dog all have headaches. This suggests something like carbon monoxide poisoning. Headache associated with dizziness. Think about cerebellar infarction. Headache associated with occult trauma. So ask about it. Could be things like a subdural hematoma. So these are the red flags. The great clinician asks the patient about these red flags and writes in their notes, no peripartum, no clotting disorder, no dizziness, no neurological findings. They'll list out these things in a yes-no format. And that makes a great chart, and that suggests that the person has given good care. But I like the way you begin this. I really like the way, if we go all the way back to the start, let's get rid of their pain first, and then we'll delve deeper into a discussion about what's going on here. Stuart, I think you've given us a really nice overview and approach, a little bit different to the patient who presents with headache. I like it. You've done well.
It's a C3 project. Continuous core content. Clinical approaches to emergency medicine's most common and dangerous conditions. A bit of a postscript here. I wanted to tell you about two things. First of all, This Won't Hurt a Bit. This Won't Hurt a Bit is our show for non-medically trained people, sort of for the whole family. We've really been working hard on that, developing it, evolving it. If you haven't listened to it, do us a favor. Go over to iTunes and check it out and give us a rating and some feedback, because we really would like that to become a pretty big show. It actually is already doing quite well, but the more people, you guys, that go and listen, the better. And, you know, have a listen, then decide if it's okay for your family. I think it is. There's lots of really good stuff in there. And actually, as part of that process of learning how to do sort of narrative-based instruction, as it were, on the This Won't Hurt a Bit show, we've decided that we're going to do that on C3. We want C3 to be something not just good, but special, really, really unique. And so we're going to convert this in the next few months, and you'll see it happen before your eyes or hear it before your ears, in that we're going to create an atmosphere so it's like you're in the emergency department. Like you're there with Stuart seeing patients and having discussions and doing sort of this review-like work, but in the atmosphere like you were seeing the patient themselves. So somebody comes in with altered mental status, we're going to try and create the atmosphere like you're there, you're working up the patient. That narrative-based learning, I think, is a way better way to learn than just sort of lecture-based. So we're going to do a little bit next month, a little bit more the next month, and then sort of flesh it out over coming months so that we get to the point where it's a fully-fledged kind of radio show for healthcare professionals in the emergency department. And I think it's going to be unique, fascinating, and really effective. So that's what you can expect on the coming months in C3. So we look forward to doing it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, thanks for listening. Herbert out.